joining us. I'm Diane Rehm, saying we can no longer ignore what's owed to us. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger asked the federal government to return more dollars to California. That state, like almost every other in the nation, faces a bleak economic outlook. Joining me to talk about the fiscal shape states are in and the difficult choices they face in balancing their budgets, Chris Edwards with the Cato Institute, Ezra Klein at the Washington Post, and Nick Johnson with the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Joining us from her office in Colorado, Corina Eckel. She's with the National Conference of State Legislatures. And, of course, we invite you to join us as well. 800-433-8850. Send us your email, if you like, to drshow@wamu.org, or you can send us a tweet or visit us on Facebook. Good morning to everyone.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
And are you there, Corina?
Yes, good morning.
Good, thank you. Ezra Klein, let me start with you. Tell us just how bad this California picture really is.
Well, I mean, it's pretty bad. You're seeing deep, deep, deep cuts at the University of California system, which, being sort of the crown jewel of California, tends to be insulated. You've seen really, really deep reductions in state services, thousands of jobs lost. California's had its credit downgraded. David Paterson, the governor of New York, has begun sort of offhandedly mentioning that California might default on its debt. Schwarzenegger and also the leaders of both congressional houses have begun talking about coming to D.C. for what they will not call a bailout, but which is nothing different than a bailout. I mean, the state is in a fiscal situation of essentially near collapse, and they pretty much don't know how to get out of it at this point.
Here's what I don't understand. Governor Schwarzenegger has said that California gets back only 78 cents on every dollar it sends to Washington in taxes. Then Barbara Boxer comes out and says Washington sends back $1.45 for every dollar it sends. So who's right, Nick?
In good economic times, California has a lot of millionaires, a lot of very wealthy people that are paying relatively high taxes under the federal tax system because we have a progressive federal tax system. So California has a lot of rich people that are paying a lot into the federal fisc. That 78 cents on the dollar figure is an old number from the time of the economic expansion.
That's what Barbara Boxer has said.
And Senator Boxer is correct in this case. Right now, given the decline in federal tax revenue nationwide due to the nation's economic problems, due to the increased costs of providing services, and due to the Economic Recovery Act, which sent tens and tens of billions of dollars to California. California is actually now getting a lot more money back from Washington, as are all other states, than paying in taxes. And this is exactly the right policy to be pursuing in a deep recession. This is fiscal stimulus when interest rates are near zero. This was the point of the Recovery Act, and it's working.
So, Chris Edwards, what is California to do when, on the one hand, its governor says we don't have enough money? Is it going to go bankrupt?
I don't know whether a whole state can go bankrupt. We've seen towns and cities in California go bankrupt. There is a long-term structural problem here that California is one of the states that sort of gets the short end of the stick from the federal granting system. California, in the long run, only gets about $4 back for every $5 they send to Washington in spending. So, you know, that's why I favor decentralizing the American Federation so that rich states like California that have a lot of spending requirements can keep the money in California and spend locally in California. They can't push taxes any higher, nor would that be a good idea because they've got a 12% unemployment rate. They've got the sixth highest tax burden amongst the 50 states. They've got the highest corporate tax rate of any state, and they've got one of the highest personal income tax rates in the country. They need to. They've got a gigantic pension problem. There's 10,000 retired California state and local workers who have pensions of more than $100,000 a year. It's absolutely remarkable. If you're a public safety employee in California, you can retire at 50, age 50, with 90% of your income in pension annually, with inflation protection for the rest of your life. Pensions are an absolutely massive problem. Arnold Schwarzenegger is promising to do something about employee compensation. He wants to require employees to contribute more to their own pensions, and he wants to cut wages and salaries. One more statistic, the average compensation of state and local workers in California is the highest in the country, easily at $86,000 a year. It's remarkable.
So Ezra Klein, did, in fact, California get itself into this situation by paying these enormous salaries and wage compensation?
I'm not as convinced that these salaries are a huge part of the problem here. What I think you see, too, is a couple other things, right? Proposition 13, one of the reasons why California has a very sort of high income tax burden is because we've, and I'm a Californian, we've totally destroyed our capacity to do property taxes.
Remind us what
Prop 13 was part of the big tax package in, I believe, the 70s, passed by Howard Jarvis. And it was a proposition that limited property taxes in the state. So we're a lot of states do a lot of their funding off of both residential and, more to the point, commercial property taxation. California can't. So a lot of that got shifted onto income. But the bigger problem for California is actually not its economic storm here. And there are other things like Countrywide and the mortgage bust that hit it. It's a political dysfunction. In California, you need two-thirds of the legislature to agree to A, pass a budget, or B, to raise taxes. Now, I think people should think about that real hard when they look at Washington, right? And ask what would happen if Barack Obama needed 67 votes to pass a budget. He didn't get that this year, God knows. And beyond that, you have the proposition process in California, which spends a ton of the state's money through the ballot box. People vote for things that sound good, you know, education programs, after-school programs. And then there's a little note in the Constitution saying 3% of funding every year goes here. So what you have in California is a system where the majority neither controls how much money they're spending nor how much they're raising, really. And that creates essentially eventually a fiscal crisis, because when it came, they couldn't respond.
Nick Johnson, political problems as well as economic ones.
Well, there's no question the supermajority has wreaked havoc with California's budget process. It's essentially a failure of accountability. A majority party does not have the ability, the responsibility to write a balanced budget. We need to give the majority party the responsibility for doing that. And if they fail, the voters can have their say. But it's also important to remember that actually this is an economic crisis at its core. California during expanding times was able to balance its budget. It's the foreclosure crisis hit hardest and earliest in California, in Nevada, in Florida, in Michigan. And those are the states that now are facing the biggest fiscal problems. And I think that's why it's imperative to keep our eye on the economic ball and to really think about the responsibility of Congress to help address the fiscal problems of the states, because it's an economic crisis at its core, and part of the solution has to be part of our overall response to the jobs crisis.
Nick Johnson, he's director of the State Fiscal Project at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Ezra Klein is with the Washington Post. Chris Edwards is with the Cato Institute. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Karina Eckel, how unusual is California's problem? What's the outlook for other states around the country?
Right. Well, you know, the combination of factors that make California unique have been addressed by your other guests. And so the situation there does have both the fiscal component and also the political component. So they're absolutely right about that. And in fact, when I think about all the ties that are binding California lawmakers, I kind of think they need a budget Houdini, somebody who can, you know, break them loose. And there is some momentum for a constitutional convention there. But California is essentially among all of the states of the nation that are facing very serious fiscal problems. As you pointed out at the beginning of the show, there is a bleak fiscal situation out there. And in fact, what's surprising is that the state fiscal problems have been so bad up to this point, it's hard to imagine that they can get worse. But what we're hearing from legislative fiscal directors around the country is that the coming budget cycle could be worse than what they've seen so far to this point. And there is no expectation for an immediate turnaround on this thing. We're expecting another 18 months at least of pretty serious fiscal problems, longer in many states.
What do states look to protect first? What do states look to cut first, Karina?
Well, you know, on the cutting side, you know, they go for some of the what people call low-hanging fruit, some of the programs that are nice to do, some economic development programs, arts programs, some education programs that are for at-risk youth, those kinds of things that are nice to do, you think they're important to do, and they are important to do, but maybe not essential to the health and safety and welfare of citizens. The programs that tend to be protected are K-12 education in particular and healthcare programs. But in this climate, in this fiscal crisis, all programs have been subject to cuts and everything has been on the table. So it's serious enough that even the programs that typically are protected have been unable to be protected just because the problems are so significant.
And, of course, there at the University of California, you've got the threat or the reality of 10% increases in tuition.
Well, you know, higher education does tend to get hit more during economic downturns, largely because lawmakers look at funding for higher education and they see that there are other sources of revenue, largely tuition and fees that come from students and their parents. So there is this other source that a lot of other programs don't have available to them. On the other side, when the economy improves and state fiscal situations get better, we often see higher education getting higher than average spending increases to help make up for the cuts.
Karina Eckel, she's fiscal program director at the National Conference of State Legislatures. We'll be back with more on state debt. Your calls. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking about the kind of economic pressures states all over the country are facing, most especially California. Here in the studio, three guests: Ezra Klein of The Washington Post, Nick Johnson of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, and Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute. Karina Eckel is on the line with us from Colorado. She's with the National Conference of State Legislatures. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. We've got lots of emails, lots of telephone calls. I gather that the central question is whether the federal government should step in and help out California. Ezra.
Here would be the case for it. The states cannot deficit spend. And what you really want to do during a recession, if you're listening to Keynes or a lot of economists, is you need to be able to deficit spend. You need to be able to have the government come in and create the demand and create the spending that needs to happen while individuals and businesses are, for completely rational reasons, cutting back. The other thing about that is it is the most efficient stimulus. If you think of building a bridge, right? If you think of the federal government building a bridge for stimulus, it's got to find contractors, it's got to do the bidding. It takes a while to get that program off the ground. If you think of California, who is thinking of, say, firing 10,000 teachers next year, or maybe many more, They don't need to worry about how to do that. If they get the money to not fire those teachers are not fired. Those kids are not in more crowded classrooms. Those state employees still have jobs. So you can move a lot faster on stimulus by filling these state budget gaps than you could by trying to do more infrastructure spending or other things of that nature.
But, Chris Edwards, wouldn't more federal help for California simply encourage that state to continue in the ways of spending it's already done?
Yeah, I think the gigantic federal stimulus last year just papered over some of these real deep structural problems in the states. I mean, California's got to restructure its K-12 education system. They spend much more than the average state on K-12 education. And so far, it's generally been exempt from cuts. I think, again, the pension system in the state and local governments is a $3 trillion problem. State and local pension funds are underfunded by $3 trillion, according to a recent University of Chicago study. That's about $27,000 for every household in the United States. So states have to tackle that problem. So even if the economy revives down the road, these state and local workers are just enormously expensive. State and local compensation is half of all state budgets. It's a very big dollar cost. And so they've got to tackle that problem. And I don't think a bailout from Washington is the right answer.
Bailout from Washington, Nick Johnson.
Yeah, state pension costs have essentially nothing to do with current state budget shortfalls. These are shortfalls in states' operating budgets, which pay their current expenses for education and health care and so on. The challenge we face right now is that, as Ezra said, the federal government did provide substantial funds, which are creating and protecting well over 300,000 jobs right now. And those funds, in turn, those workers take that money, they spend it at their local grocery store and so on. So that's a major boost to the economy as we enter what most economists think will be a relatively slow recovery. The current federal funds to states are playing a really huge role. Here's the problem. The Medicaid funds to states, the additional Medicaid to states, expires this coming December. That was one of the two major pots of money provided to states. The other was some additional education money. That's also running out. That money, all of that money, the end of the Medicaid funds, that'll go away before state revenues have recovered. And so what Congress is considering, what was in the House jobs bill and what the Senate is going to consider, is extending the relief beyond the current scheduled December expiration long enough so that state revenues can start to come back, which they probably will as unemployment starts to decline.
Here's an email from Vincent, who he describes himself as a small business specialist. Karine, I'll ask you to answer this. He says, California has a crisis of management, not a financial crisis. Governor Schwarzenegger has managed the finances of a state with a huge revenue base very poorly. Why can't people see that? What's your reaction, Karina?
Well, you can't only say that there is a management crisis. I mean, the evidence is overwhelming that there's a fiscal crisis. This nation has been in a recession. The impact on state revenues in California and around the country have been deep. We're seeing states collecting today what they were collecting 4 years ago, 5 years ago. In some cases, in Michigan's case, they're collecting today what they collected in 1997. So there is an enormous fiscal crisis confronting the states. As your other guests already indicated, California has some interesting structural issues, some constitutional limitations around increasing taxes with a supermajority vote, passing the budget with a supermajority vote, the spending levels that are guaranteed in the state constitution, you know, the impact from the initiative process and propositions. There's so many factors in California that have tied the governor's hands, the state legislature's hands, in trying to be flexible and fleet-footed in dealing with this crisis. So there's a combination of factors that have come together to create an even deeper problem in California than many other states face.
Ezra Klein, wouldn't you have to have a second stimulus in order to get money to California?
You do. And, you know, one way to look at this, the Congressional Budget Office just the other day came out with a new look at the deficit, the federal deficit. And I think a lot of people remember back to the days of late 08, early 09, and it was so much worse then. We felt like we were on the cusp of another Great Depression. We feel like we should be improving. There's not that much panic. What the CBO found was that we actually have a much higher deficit in the first quarter of 2010 than 2009, despite the fact that we're not doing this financial intervention really. really anymore. Now, why? And the reason is that the financial crisis, as we sort of expected, has given way to the following to the recession. And the recession is actually much more expensive. That's where Medicaid costs, unemployment insurance, all of that comes in. But so the idea that we are out of financial crisis danger, but I think because there feels like an improvement from that panic, people sort of underestimate the degree to which we are now trapped in a truly severe recession. We did a stimulus in 2009, right on the cusp of the financial side of this, but there is just still a very, very, very deep spending demand gap.
So how likely is it that there will be a second stimulus?
Quite likely. So in the Senate, Senator Dorgan and Senator Durbin have been charged by the Democrats with figuring out their new jobs bill, and they're splitting that into four different parts, green spending, public employees, so state spending essentially, and infrastructure, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the final one, but they're supposed to report back essentially later this month. So there is the knowledge on the Democrats that they need another jobs bill. How big it will be is going to be a very interesting question, because they're caught worrying about whether they don't want to be seen as deficit increasing before the next election. But if you're not willing to up the deficit a bit, you're not going to be able to do very much in terms of stimulus.
Chris Edwards.
I think the Keynesian theory that Ezra has expanded on here is completely wrong and doesn't fit the evidence. We had a $1.4 trillion federal deficit last year, $1.5 trillion or higher this year, trillion-dollar deficits for years to come. And, you know, the unemployment rate is 10%. It clearly hasn't worked. I think, thank goodness, the state and local governments are required to balance their budget every year, else they'd be as irresponsible as federal politicians. I don't think that there's anything wrong with the big, gigantic budget battles that take place every year in states like California. We live in a democracy. Money is tight. Money is tight for families and businesses, so money should be tight for state and local lawmakers as well. Battling over priorities in the budget is fine. The budget should be balanced every year, in my view.
I just want to answer to the point on Keynesian economics there, because you hear this a lot. Yeah, we have a 10% unemployment rate, and we did stimulus, so clearly stimulus doesn't work. Every private forecaster, we're not talking about the government guys here, we're talking about the private guys who provide the stuff to Merrill Lynch, to all the people who need to make investment decisions off of it. They say stimulus has eased the picture. They say it's increased employment, it has increased demand. We are in a very bad recession. The fact that we are at 10% and not 14% or not 12% is probably due to stimulus. I agree with Chris that we haven't done enough of it, but I don't think that would be his read of the evidence. But to say it doesn't work is not where the evidence lies right now.
Nick Johnson.
You know, Chris made the point that we need to be thinking about impacts on families, about how this is happening at the community level. And we've been talking some about compensation. States and local governments have already cut 130,000 jobs in this downturn. Cutting salaries, cutting wages, as Governor Schwarzenegger and others have proposed, takes demand right out of the economy. And it actually is going to make the recession even worse.
Karine, let me understand which states, if any, are doing fairly well.
Well, if you live in North Dakota, you're probably not too concerned about what's going on nationally. But if you live in any other state in this nation, you're living in a state with pretty significant budget problems.
Even Montana?
Montana, yes. You know, they were sort of late. Montana, West Virginia, Texas, Oklahoma, Alaska, Wyoming, because they have natural resource-based economies as part of the overall mix, they were buffered early during the economic downturn. So they didn't go into the recession as quickly as many of the other states, like California, Nevada, Arizona, Florida, for instance, because of the housing bubble problem. But those states have ultimately sort of shifted into having fiscal problems of their own. In fact, Oklahoma has one of the biggest problems in the nation right now. But again, they didn't really have the problems other states were facing in 08 or 09. Their problem has emerged now. But yes, even Montana, although it does have a natural resource-based economy, was sort of slow feeling the impact of the recession. But lawmakers there are telling us that they, too, are seeing some problems with revenue performance.
So how do you see it, as a cup three quarters empty or a new opportunity for states to take close looks at their budgets, see where they can cut, or sit back, wait for a new stimulus, Karina?
I think states are taking advantage of this economic crisis to do things they perhaps wouldn't otherwise have done. They didn't need to do some of these things. They didn't have the pressure on them to make some of the choices, very difficult choices, that they're making now. So we're seeing states look at some new efficiencies, some consolidations. We have the state of Utah implementing a four-day work week for savings in a variety of arenas, energy savings and other kinds of things. So I think states are trying to be creative and innovative in this environment, and perhaps that's the silver lining.
Do you see that happening, Chris?
Yeah, I think it's a good thing. I think recessions and slowdowns allow private corporations to restructure and families to rethink their household budgets. I think the same is true for government. If you look at California, they still could do more. When Arnold Schwarzenegger first came into office, he put together a big blue ribbon panel that spent a year digging through in detail the state budget, and it came up with 1,200 detailed recommendations for savings, often modest savings, that are sensible, reasonable kind of savings. I understand from fiscal wonks in California that almost all of these have not been implemented yet in California. So let's get that performance review off the shelf from 5 years ago and go to it. Let's look through the entire budget, as President Obama said about the federal budget. Let's look line by line and find efficiencies.
Do you think that's really going to happen?
It's going. I think the fiscal pressures on states won't let up, even if the economy recovers. I think, again, the elephant in the room here is the pension issue. It's absolutely massive, and there's going to be pressure on states for years.
Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We'll open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Davidsonville, Maryland. Good morning, Gloria. You're on the air.
Good morning. You touched on this earlier. Could you further explain what was passed in the 70s regarding the referendums and the effects it has on California, and whether it's good or bad?
Go ahead, Nick.
So in the late 70s, California passed Proposition 13, which is a huge package of constitutional changes. They limited the ability of local governments to increase property taxes and actually locked in people's assessment values so that they would essentially never rise. So you have it created huge disparities between
neighboring. So if you have a huge house, the value is going up.
But your assessment is limited to a very slow rise. So you have a situation where younger homeowners who are relatively new in their house and their neighbor who's been in the house for a number of years pay wildly different property taxes. And this, of course, frustrates everybody and undermines this faith in the whole system of government. Over the years, to get around some of these constitutional constraints in California, there have been a number of other things layered on top. We've talked about supermajority requirement. There's a requirement that a certain percentage of the budget go to public education. There's a requirement that certain revenue streams be dedicated for certain services. It all makes for, as Corinna said, a very complicated knot to untangle. And there's a few other states that are in similar situations where fiscal policy is essentially done through the ballot box that is become almost impossible for state legislatures.
Bad idea, Chris.
Yeah, I'm for having tight overall budget caps, but then giving governors and legislatures a lot of flexibility on how to reform their budget. And there's a lot of initiatives, especially in the western state, that are sort of forcing spending. Colorado is another state where a voter-passed referendum requires certain amounts of education spending. I think that's a bad idea.
But the problem in Colorado comes back to the overall cap that they passed. Not enough money was being spent on education. Rather than getting rid of the cap, as they probably should have, they decided to set aside a large
California has Proposition 13, which limits property tax revenue. But again, there isn't an overall shortage of revenue in California. It has the sixth highest overall tax burden, state and local government, in the country. So I don't think revenue shortage is the problem here.
Karina Eccles, how do you respond to that, money is really not the problem in California? There is no shortage. It's that salaries and pensions are really the problem out there.
You know, it's a complicated question, and the answer has a lot of facets to it. I would say that California, over time, like many states, has created a system of government that provides a level of services that apparently the citizens want. That's what they have been willing to pay for in the past. Then we hit this deep recession, nearly unprecedented loss in revenue performance, things that we haven't seen, since the Great Depression. So it puts a whole new focus on what's going on, what money the state does have, how these reduced scarce resources are going to be allocated across programs that it appears that the public has supported in the past. So it's a combination of things. I mean, granted, California has had a general fund budget of you know, $100 billion. But when you start factoring in now that they're to, I think it's closer to $85 billion, if we translate those kinds of problems into even personal finances, if you build your household budget with a mortgage and a car payment and insurance and, you know, kids going to college, you factor all that in and then you lose a big chunk of your income, you have to really rethink what's important and how you're going to manage it. So it is partly a revenue problem. I think it's unfair to say that it's not partly a revenue problem. But having said that, there's been a lot of decisions around employee compensation, as your other guests have said, some other decisions that when times get tight, you may not be able to afford everything that you've previously authorized. And that's why we're seeing deep cuts.
Karina Eccles, she's Fiscal Program Director of the National Conference of State Legislatures. We'll take a short break. I hope we've answered your question, Gloria, and we'll answer many more after the news.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which provides solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
The lucrative and the illegal business of wildlife trafficking. An expose of the world's most notorious wildlife dealer and what's being done to fight the illicit trade. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. We were talking about the difficulties in which many states around the country find themselves, California being a first-rate example. Let's go to Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Good morning, Jim. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just had a couple quick points and questions that I wanted to put up. And I've heard everybody talk about the states have balanced budgets. But year in and year out, North Carolina and most of the other states end up borrowing large sums of money, which further ties their hands. So it's really kind of and they've done it a lot with accounting games as far as moving funds around to claim their balance. How will that stuff ever be changed and addressed and allow them to build the funds that you were talking about they need for when the economy turns down to either protect the spending levels they have or spend it for stimulus?
Nick Johnson.
Yeah, states do have some ability to borrow, and sometimes we're a little oversimplistic in how we talk about this. So what states have is balanced budget requirements in their operating budget. So that's setting aside their capital funds. They issue bonds all the time to build roads and build school buildings and so on. That's appropriate and necessary. It's a way of spreading out the cost of that construction over time. What we can look at is, well, what could states do to even things out better? How could states balance out this problem of the booms and the busts, the ups and the downs? One good answer is better rainy day funds, better structured rainy day funds. States actually built bigger reserves in the last expansion than ever before, over 11% reserves. But that turns out that's not enough, and states can change their own rules. And I think the federal government could bring some pressure to bear as well to get more money into those reserve funds in good times.
And during the break, Ezra, you were talking about the kinds of pressures that the federal government could put on those states.
Well, people occasionally sort of waggishly say that the federal government should approach the states like the International Monetary Fund approaches a failing country. So the International Monetary Fund will go in with a loan and say, you can have this loan if you restructure the way your government works. That would obviously be very hard for the federal government to do. But there is something to it, that at the very least, the states do need to feel the responsibility. A lot of them, like California, do need to restructure the way the federal government works. And analytically, I think it is how we should look at this, even if it's not the exact policy we should put into place.
But let me give you a different view, this one from Bart in Oklahoma City. He says, the facts are revenues and expenses. In most states, personnel costs represent 60 to 70% of the budget. To suggest that personnel costs is not a problem in California seems to be missing the issue. To suggest that politics is the main problem also, I think, is missing the boat. The reason the political constraints were established in the first place was a perception that politicians were out of control and not following the wishes of the people. Chris.
It's a very interesting thing to look at. Most of these basic state requirements to balance their budgets came in a century ago under the progressive era. There was a big movement towards good and cleaner and more honest government, and balanced budget requirements often got into state constitutions in places like Virginia over a century ago because of that basic reason that politicians can be irresponsible if we don't hold their feet to the fire with rules. And we see, of course, that at the federal level. So 49 of the 50 states have to balance their budgets every year. There's about 20 states or so that have various kind of budget caps, like Colorado, that put caps on the overall budget. This is all a good thing. State policymakers cheat. There's no doubt about it. They're increasingly issuing bonds, which are only supposed to be for long-term infrastructure, to cover short-term budget holes. We've seen that in California and other states. So there's I'm in favor of these structural restraints, but there is cheating on the side.
Let's go now to Aubrey, Texas. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, Diane. I really love your show.
Thank you.
You know, I'm a retired deputy sheriff from Los Angeles County, and I hear all this demonizing of the pension plans, you know, and the blame for California's fiscal problems being that. My mother's a 30-year veteran of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department as well, and she worked her entire life for this menial salary, very, very low. Our family struggled. We were by no means rich, struggled to make ends meet every day, and now she has this very small pension. And to see her and people like me demonized when we were civil servants and we took a lower-paying job, knowing that the benefit package on the backside, the health insurance benefits that they're calling Cadillac plans, these are the things that we were sacrificing the immediate gratification and income for these other things in the long run. And now to be demonized for it, a lot like they're demonizing the unions, which is a totally different issue. I take great offense at that.
Thanks for calling, Lisa. Karina, Lisa makes some good points.
Yeah, she does. And so did the caller from Oklahoma City who talked about personnel costs. I mean, it's all wrapped up together. And certainly, you know, personnel costs are one of the most expensive areas for state and local governments. So what we've seen, of course, as a result of states trying to scale back their spending are these furloughs that are being implemented around the country, layoffs and potentially more of those coming. States asking employees to contribute more to their health care plans, to their retirement plans, all of that sort of being wrapped up together. But, you know, there's unevenness around the country in the level of compensation, what's being contributed on the part of state and local governments to health care programs, to retirement programs. So the caller from Texas, you know, she's talking about a situation she experienced in California. But, you know, that it's uneven across the nation. And there has been, for a very long time, this notion that public sector employees were paid less and had a better compensation system. I think that's been evolving, and I think maybe your other guests can talk about that.
Ezra.
I mean, I think we do get a little bit back to the political questions here, because you sort of go back and forth on, is it revenue, spending? Obviously, public employees are a big part of spending. Obviously, California had a huge drop in revenues. But I don't think that that is necessarily the place to look. The question, I think, in the immediate term, because all states will always have fiscal emergencies, we will have recessions, we will have financial crises, is why has California had this much trouble responding? And I think there, it isn't the balanced budget amendment that's been the political constraint. It is, on the one hand, the propositions which tie up the money that gets spent in the country, but no, in the state. But number two, it's the fact that you have a two-thirds majority to pass a budget or to raise a tax. And to just make this very clear, the minority in California, and this would be true no matter who is in it, sees a political opportunity here. If the state sort of fails, what that means is that the majority has failed. But the minority has the power to make the majority fail because of the way we give them a sort of a veto point.
So what lessons do you take from California?
The lesson you take is that you cannot have a minority with both the incentive and the power to make the majority fail. And I think people are talk about California, but you should really think about this nationally. We will have to make terribly hard decisions in the next 20 or 30 years. According to the CBPP, we will have a debt at 300% of GDP by 2050. These are going to be much harder decisions with health care and with pensions and with Social Security and with taxes and everything else than we've had to make yet. And if you look at the way Congress works right now, I don't think you can say to yourself, well, that's going to go just great.
Nick Johnson.
What states spend most of their money on is education, health care, transportation, public safety. Yeah, a big part of the cost is the cost of putting somebody in those classrooms. When we talk about public employees, that's mostly school teachers, community college instructors, it's firefighters, it's cops. I think we, you know, for the long term, we clearly need a highly qualified workforce. All the research in education suggests that it's highly qualified teachers that are going to turn around our K-12 system. And I think the size of the gaps we're facing right now cannot be closed without doing really irreparable harm to our schools, to our universities,
to public safety.
So you're
saying there has to be a federal stimulus package.
There have to be two other things, actually. There has to be more funds from the federal government, an extension of the existing federal stimulus funds. Yeah. The other thing is, you know, we talk a lot about the need for balance. We need a balanced approach in how we respond to this at the state level. And that means not just looking at the spending side, but looking at the revenue side. A lot of states have done too much in the way of tax cuts. They give away too much in the way of tax credits that don't get enough scrutiny. There are a number of governors that are starting to put those under the microscope and saying, are we getting our bang for our buck from all these tax cuts and tax credits? Can we think about modernizing our tax system to bring in more revenue to pay for the services that are getting cut, but beyond a certain point, people aren't willing to give up the fundamentals of public education and health care and so
Chris,
on.
Chris, it looks as though you agree.
I think we can have state and local governments that cost less and work better and higher quality. And I think we have to think of major restructuring with K-12 education and Medicaid. Let's go to an individual voucher system where we provide the basic decentralized benefits to individuals and let markets compete. The California Teachers Union has been against every kind of education reform initiative on the table. The other big area, and there probably is more agreement here, we should do more privatization of airports, which are owned by state and local governments, of highways, and you see that going on all over the country. It is a way to get the infrastructure built without having to increase the tax burden, and so I think that there is a broad area of agreement there.
But how much faith would the general public have if those kinds of services were privatized?
How much faith would they have?
Yes, considering the fact that you see the U.S. Postal Service, for example, going hugely into debt.
Right. Well, the Postal Service, of course, owned by the federal government. I would be in favor of privatizing the post office, like Germany has. So, yeah, we need to look around the world at examples of privatization abroad. There's been much more road privatization in places like Canada and Australia, for example, than in the United States. Most European countries have their major airports are private. There's no reason why we shouldn't privatize airports in this country. Heathrow, for example, is private. So we don't need to be spending money on those things that the private sector could be doing.
You know, and you can go in a lot of different directions on this. I mean, you mentioned Medicaid, which is much, much, much cheaper than private insurance. I mean, not even close. So I don't know if people really want to get into the argument where we use the recession as a moment to sort of push through major ideological initiatives. If you do, what you want to do is federalize healthcare spending, because in every other country that has a universal healthcare system, they pay half as much as we do. Similar outcomes, no uninsured. That would be the single biggest thing we could do. If we could match Canada's healthcare spending, we would not have a deficit problem. It would go away instantly. Now, do I think we can do it? Probably not. But we can make big changes in both directions, but the capacity to do that is probably limited in the near term.
Let's go to Grand Rapids, Michigan. John, you're on the air.
Yes, Ms. Ream, thank you very much.
Surely.
I just would like very much for someone to bring balance to the trashing that Proposal 13 gets. And what really upsets me is they make this very divisive by telling the younger generations that they unfairly pay high taxes and their older next-door neighbors pay nothing. And I would like to say that I was once a very young home buyer, and after I had my home for 5 or 6, 7 years, developers came out into the country, built all around me. Then the people came in, tightly knit groups of forces behind the school system to put in these huge schools. I told my wife, I said, honey, I said, we have 2 years left and we have to move because we can't control the taxation on our home. Many, many people who are young that buy their homes will never retire in those homes without something like Proposal 13 to protect them.
John, thanks for calling. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Nick Johnson.
Well, the problem with Proposition 13 has really nothing to do with how much overall spending there is. It has. I mean, that's part of the problem. But the problem I was getting at was the inequity of having people in neighboring houses pay vastly different amounts of taxes on their houses.
Let me ask you all, starting with you, Karina, do you think that if and when the economy comes back, that states will have taken lessons from this kind of really difficult period, or will they simply go back to spending as they always have?
I think absolutely there are lessons learned that lawmakers will take away from this recession. We know that they have faced, again, nearly unprecedented declines in revenue collections that have forced them to rethink, how they do business, what they do, how they do it. They have been able to take advantage of the crisis to impose innovations and creativity and consolidations and things that otherwise would not have been available to them. They're not going to want to go through this again, certainly not anytime soon. So I think they're going to look at what's occurred during this recession, take advantage of the lessons learned, implement those. There might be some seepage, there might be some returns and trying to get some funding restored to previous levels for important programs. But I think there is a long-term lesson that states will learn from this.
What do you think, Chris?
I think that there's going to be long-term budget pressures on state and local governments. We're not going to have another boom like the 90s or the 2000s where the revenues pour into state governments and they can spend, increase their spending rapidly. On the spending side, you've got this massive pension problem that's not going away. State and local governments have a lot of baby boomers that are now retiring. The costs are exploding. On the revenue side, you've got increasing tax competition globally. California companies don't have to stay in California anymore. They can move to low-tax Nevada, low-tax Mexico, low-tax China. There's only so much states can and should be doing on the tax side. They've got to restructure the spending.
Do you believe there will be a second stimulus?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that the polls and the congressional Democrats are falling, and they just don't have there's no political willpower there, I think, to do that.
Ezra, are the states going to go back to business as usual, or will they have learned lessons?
Like Chris, I don't think they'll be able to. What we usually like to do out of recessions is grow our way out of them, right? We get into another boom, we get into another real healthy growth period, and we get out. I think a lot of economists think we're not going to do that this time, that consumers aren't going to spend like they once did, that we're not going to be able to get out of it just by getting our economies back on their feet. And so a lot of states will have to make some of the changes they need. Will they make enough of them? I'm highly skeptical of that.
You mean they won't take out lots of these pensions?
Well, the pensions aren't really the part I'm concerned about. I'm much more worried about the way they do these processes. And do I think California is going to go far enough in fixing its extremely dysfunctional political system? I don't, because I think that, for any change, you have a lot of opponents. And the status quo doesn't quite have defenders, but at least people are used to it.
How about you, Nick?
I think there's a huge opportunity going forward for thinking about some of the structural things that Ezra has been talking about. A huge opportunity about thinking about modernizing modernizing state revenue system. I think it's very straightforward for states to do a lot of improvements to their revenue systems that won't drive businesses away. There's very little evidence
of that. Is there the will to do it?
Well, the other thing that I'd like to see going forward, and I think is very possible, is a real rethinking of the federal-state relationship. We've been putting a lot of responsibilities onto states. We expect them to sustain those in good times and bad, and then turning our backs on them in a recession is just not an option. I'd like to see kind of permanent counter-cyclical mechanisms at the federal level that can help states get through bad times like this without decimating public services.
You're nodding your head.
I agree with that, and I think you're seeing it a little bit in healthcare. This whole Ben Nelson Nebraska deal, where the federal government will pay for all of Nebraska's Medicaid expansion, they're thinking of moving that to the entire country, which would actually be a great idea. We split Medicaid between the federal government and the states, and of course Medicaid gets much more expensive when recession hits because more people need it and revenues go down.
We need the feds
to come in for that.
Ezra Klein at the Washington Post, Nick Johnson, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, Chris Edwards of the Cato Institute, and Karina Eckel of the National Conference of State Legislatures. Thank you all so much.
Well, thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.